Title: Record On. The letter O of On is a record.
Warning, warning, nuclear attack!
The Specials play at a packed-out venue. Damon Albarn.
The Specials remain a beacon of great political awareness and empathy. This was the time of Rock Against Racism and Anti-Nazi League.
We were voicing things, and until they are, its light will be undimmed.
The cream of the crop, the top of the tree, the Specials.
Elvis Costello, Pauline Black, Simon Jordan.
The combining of two cultures to make something joyous.
Don't be scared to embrace the difference between people.
Horace Panther, Johnny Chandler.
I'll sum up the Specials in a few sentences. Don't be daft.
It doesn't matter what colour skin you are, how you dress. If you're into the same kind of things, then that's great.
Message from the people to the people. That's right.
The Specials.
The Specials. They were all seven individuals. A real spectrum of society. Trying to keep that in one band proved too much.
A message to you.
Ride.
Okay.
And then on the way back, we'll pick
this
up.
This is a break.
God, I hope so.
Where's the accelerator?
Jeff.
Is that the accelerator? That one. Is that the accelerator?
That's the accelerator.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the right.
Okay.
The far right is the accelerator.
Okay.
That's the break.
And what's on the far left is the emergency.
It's emergency.
Break, which,
yeah.
Yeah.
You don't need that.
Okay.
We'll take it slow.
Yeah.
When in doubt, just slow down and jump out.
Okay. Slow down and jump out. Yeah.
A montage of Specials gigs throughout the years. Black and white footage of the seven-piece band. Terry Hall.
Basically, it's just world domination.
Terry smiles. April 1981, the Specials spend 10 days recording Ghost Town in an 8-track home studio in Leamington Spa. The song spends 3 weeks at number one in the UK charts, culminating in a BBC Top of the Pops appearance on the 9th of July, 1981. In the dressing room after, the band split.
What got you back to together again?
I think, for me, it was just I wanted to see everyone again. And, you know, such a big part of my life growing up. And then everybody disappeared. And I just wanted to be in a room with everybody and see how we're all doing.
2009.
Terry particularly always had gone forward and always had written new music. So he'd kind of exorcised the ghost of the Specials and only kind of reprised it on his own terms.
Lindvall was trying to get Jerry and Terry to sort of sit in the same room together and stuff like that.
Simon Jordan played a huge part in getting us back together.
I was in Spain sitting there thinking I really want to do things I want to do. I'd started a car magazine. I was doing things in the film industry and other bits and bobs that I really would love to put the Specials back together again.
None of them could do the Specials. They went out and did various versions of the Specials, but none of them could do it without Terry because Terry had the cool factor. He was an artist in his own right. He'd been through all these bands and made a success of them.
When I sat with Lindvall specifically and Terry, I didn't know whether at the time it was false modesty, but the more I spoke to them, it was like, but no one's going to want to listen to us. That time has gone. No one really is that worried about us. And I said, no, you're wrong. You're really wrong.
I got the phone call from Lindvall saying there is a possibility that the Specials could refilm. What do you think? It took me probably about 30 seconds to think that this might be a really good idea.
I got six out of the seven back together. Part of the reason why we didn't get the old seven back together, Jerry wanted to do things differently, but the audience, as far as the plans were, just want to hear the music. But Jerry wanted to move the music on. But Jerry, this band stopped for 19 years. We can't change the songs. We've got to deliver the songs as they are. And I think that's where Jerry made his mistake.
Yes, Jerry was definitely the elephant in the front room. But, hey, you make choices, and I'm an adult, so I made choices, you know. End of.
The Specials did better as a unit than any individual.
Individual. It's all of us
together. And that's why we're back together.
This town is this town. It's coming like a ghost town.
It broke in the newspapers. There was a potential interest in reforming the band. Everywhere I went, people were saying, are you going to reform this band? Is this band going to reform? We'd love to see this band. When they did, was I surprised at the level of energy and competency and quality that they produced? No, these are first-class musicians.
The crowd and the atmosphere, it was insane. It's like people waited for 19 years of Steel's Back Again, and with the curtain drew and everything, the way the stage was designed, the whole place went absolutely crazy.
Specials guitarist Linval Golding. The band played a packed-out venue.
Wicked sense of humour. I mean, the original sense of wicked, like evil sense of humour.
So,
deadpan delivery.
I wish I'd have put on the tickets. Could the ugly ones go at the back? Sorry.
It was like, boom, you're back there. I was transported back to 1981 immediately.
We absolutely destroyed the place. It was really, really good.
It was just the music that my friends and I listened to, and it had such a reaction in me. So when I thought about trying to get involved with creating a reason why this iconic band with this brilliant music should get back together, it was centred in that.
The Specials always seemed very confident because, you know, they'd honed their act, if you like, when they came back. You know, that was a chance for them to really shine.
The audience loved it, so I think that made them realise that they could carry on.
It was the logical outcome. I did what I wanted to do, you know. I wanted this band to reform. I thought they deserved to be right up there in the hearts and minds of people. I didn't think that they'd gotten enough of the credit they should have got. And I just felt that for them to be out going on tour after tour after tour and seeing the demand.
10 years later, the encore tour.
Getting ready for Showtime, the very first gig on the encore tour. Wow, can you imagine, right? How did we get here?
Cologne, a sound mixer at work pre-show. Fans start arriving at the venue. The band play to a jubilant crowd.
White is white, what's black and clover? Together we'll be when war is over. Black skin, blue-eyed boys, ain't gonna fight no war.
The Specials play gigs in Brussels and Amsterdam. The audience go wild. Linval backstage.
One step at a time.
A gig in Liverpool. Fans fill the venue in Birmingham. The crowds revel in the music. New York 2022. The band admire the pimped-up suspension of a classic muscle car. Terry drives Linval and Horace around New York City in the classic Malibu Chevelle.
Cut the corner, sharp, man.
Steering wheel, man.
Yeah, this is brilliant. This, I love this. I like this, the danger of it, you know?
Well, it's dangerous. You know?
Make sure when you're going to do emergency, there's a tip so I can jump out before you do the emergency. Yeah.
Is
yes.
That power?
Yes, yeah, the power.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, power. Amazing power, yeah.
Where's the brake?
1977, police charge through crowds in Lewisham.
At one stage, a crowd surrounded Lewisham Police Station and set fire to a motorcycle belonging to a member of the press. Under police pressure and knowing that the National Front were no longer around, the crowd dispersed.
I'll say through music we bring people together. That was a challenge because at the time you have the National Front, they were dividers. And we're trying to unite people, you know?
Obviously, this was the time of Rock Against Racism and the anti-Nazi League. The Specials were sort of parallel to that.
Important? More than important, brother. This is the beginning, not the end.
Britain at the time, when the Specials came around in 1979, Britain was broken. Racism was rife. The country was in disarray.
As the fighting became more bitter, the police used heavy-duty plastic shields, never used for crowd control before, except in Belfast.
And the Specials were like the Clash, like Adam and the Ants, like Ian Dury. Everyone seemed to be kind of emanating from these places. So they were like beacons of hope in this kind of quite austere, cold, Thatcherite environment.
Police plans for the National Front remained a secret. They sealed all street entrances and members of the National Front lined up quietly in a side road. There were about 1,000 of them.
I'll tell you a story about this one guy. Never talked to a black guy before, and he was a National Front supporter. After him and me sat down and had a drink at the hotel bar, right, and we chat and chat, right, he shook my hand and goes, I had no idea. You know, because obviously the trend at the time and the way the National Front was recruiting, we had to smash that recruitment. And we want all that audience to come to us. You're welcome. Be welcome there. You got to come in with love.
At one point, ammonia was thrown at policemen.
The single, Gangsters, so it had the Specials on one side versus the Selector. The Selector ostensibly being Neil Davis at that time, which was an instrumental that he had recorded 2 years before. And we went from there. Then we were out sort of supporting the Specials, the F Club in Leeds, all these little clubs up and down the country. One of them, Elvis Costello, was there. He trod on my toe. That was my main kind of exchange I ever had with him.
Gangsters' record was that I thought it was really imaginative.
I'd never heard of the Specials till I heard Gangsters on the Radio. I thought, oh, what is that? That's wicked. I really liked it.
You just sort of hear something and you react to the energy. Comes out the speaker and just grabs you. Gangsters was like that. It just sort of made you stop. And at that moment, nothing else really kind of exists. You're just sort of in that space with that sound.
Elvis Costello.
I was familiar with that music. I love the way they had overlaid it. The idea of making another form from an existing musical form was really only heard in jazz. So I was intrigued by that. Just standing back from the excitement of actually seeing them on stage was, of course, was a whole other thing.
When we recorded Gangsters and we thought about how we would progress, it's like, well, we need our own record label. Why don't we do that? So sort of like the English equivalent of Tamla Motown or something. So it was like there was this quest to find like-minded groups, which we did with, you know, Madness, Selector and The Beat. We'd carry more weight if there was a movement, if there was more than one group.
Terry Hall.
Well, basically, we want artistic control and we want to stick out on our label what we want to stick out on our label, you know, relevant of what it is. There are a few bands and we all needed an identity. I mean, the music and the clothes, but I mean, with the label, it's a stronger thing. It's a whole movement.
For some reason, had managed to get a ticket to go to a filming of Top of the Pops. You imagine what that was like for a kid who was obsessed with everything about Top of the Pops. I managed to stand in front of Terry. You know, a story I told him many times.
trying to assure him I wasn't a stalker.
I probably heard gangsters on the radio. I have a sort of memory of that and thinking this was something that really caught me.
A few run through, right in the studio, cut it, that was it. That was a fantastic record.
The music video for A Message to You, Rudy. The band dressed in black and white perform on a stark white background.
Elvis Costello's manager was Jake Riviera, and our manager, Rick Rogers, worked with Jake Riviera previously, so it was the old boy network.
I came up with the idea that I might try some production and make sure something really vivid got on tape.
And we thought that was a good idea, because he wasn't like, you know, a big-named, heavy-handed producer who would come in and say, you know, change this, change that, you know, do this, do that.
I got to the gigs and made my mental notes and maybe even a few real notes, and I kind of knew what we were supposed to do and we shouldn't take too long doing it. There wasn't the money to do a long, intricate, piece-by-piece recording. We had to try and grab it all at once.
Producing the first album, he sort of said, oh, you know, they were doing everything wrong, but it sounded right. He didn't sort of change it. He just recorded it as it was.
I kind of held with the idea that it should have the bright attack of a punk record while playing the rhythms. If it was too rooted, like a roots reggae record, then it would just be mistaken for that and people wouldn't dial it in. I also wanted the voice to be really clear because the lyrics were so important.
We drank a lot and smoke a lot of weed. So the first record was like that.
I guess somewhere along the way, Jerry, who's a little bit younger than me, started to write these songs. He also, just from the age they were, they came out of punk bands and the attitude of punk bands.
These are songs about, you know, social issues.
They'd started out with a comment on the record business, which was about their own tribulations, and then Too Much Too Young was certainly a portrait of something young people go through together, or having a baby, and you wonder whether you should have done that.
It was the best decision we made to have Elvis. Elvis was blown up as well, you know? And I mean, he understood the music, he understood where we were coming from. Watching The Detective, he understood that, and he was the best person for the band.
Everything was done on a tight budget, on the compression of time. If the air went out of it any one day, we'd just stop and do a different song and come back to it. But most of the time, we got the songs pretty quick, as I remember. I don't remember there being a lot of angst about whether it was the version. It was mostly catching it, this side of it going too much like the live version and getting it to the pitch where it could sound like it was happening on stage, but it was still kind of had the clarity that you needed to make it a record.
When you look back at that first album, the first singles, just so much great energy, and the lyrics just totally compelling.
All of these words were being delivered by Terry Hall, and Terry Hall was 19, I think, when we made that record.
A lot of your lyrics deal with the social and political conditions in England.
There are subjects to sing about. I mean, you've got to sing about something, whatever it is. But we chose to sing about social problems.
The song that Chrissie Hynde sang on, where she really, her voice is like so important to the arrangement, is Nightclub. Nightclub! You know, she's hitting that long note with the vibrato, and it's like, it's making the chorus open up like this.
Well, it draws you in. I mean, the way the bass starts.
Something on my gravestone, you know. Great bass line.
Archive footage of the band performing at a gig. Terry smokes on stage. Linval dances in front of the crowd.
We went in to record Nightclub, because Jerry's idea is like, make a record that the BBC is going to ban. So, you know, in the lyrics, all the girls are slags or the beer tastes like piss, right? The BBC is not going to play that. So by having it banned, Jerry just thought, that's a great way to start. Have your first single banned. And we get a lot of mileage out of it, you know?
Nightclub to me was the epitome of the Specials, when they were just, it was just raw, and it was just raw energy just coming off the stage, and everybody had a place in that song, and it's a brilliantly constructed song. If anything that captured the time that we were living through, then it has to be that.
Everybody having good fun, everybody partying.
I put a piece of metal that I found out in the street on the step and hit it with a broom handle, and we doubled the snare drum with that. So if you listen on Nightclub, there's kind of this kind of clanking sound that goes along with it. Very primitive things that you would do now with a sample, but we were doing them live. That was as much as I ever produced them. It was a decent amount of comedy moments that you have to have in studios to break it down, you know. There used to be a store on Fulham Palace Road where you could buy replica guns in those days. That was just so you could walk in and you could buy a replica machine gun. They looked pretty convincing. And Neville decided to go and buy a revolver one day and came into the studio and in a gun stance, came off the street, said, "Freeze Costello," and fired the gun.
The best time of my life was when we did the first album with Elvis Costello.
Yeah, I didn't like that.
You didn't like that?
No.
Well, I liked it because, you know, I was drinking a lot more. And yeah. We under the influence
yeah,
of alcohol.
What sort of thing
it was
about
fun.
Being drunk?
I know, because...
Drunk. I was drunk once when we did this first
It's Ruddy's
album.
Fault. It's Ruddy's fault.
No, no,
treated
no,
me.
You were all...
Merry.
You were all merry, yeah.
Yeah. You go away, you was never there.
I didn't drink.
You only have half a lager, that's all you had.
But I do
half
remember the first time in America when all of you, except me, experimented with drugs.
That
you
was,
remember that?
Yes. Yeah, well, I remember Horace. When I, yeah.
First albums are always the purest energy of what it was about.
And I think Elvis captured it and conducted us in the best way. He got the vibe.
He knew what we wanted to sound like. And it was just a question of facilitating that, really. Not like we were cats that needed herding, but it was like just to make sure that we were in the room, you know, OK, everybody ready? OK, start recording when the red light goes on kind of stuff.
We had so much fun recording that album.
In retrospect, he was the perfect producer for that first album.
I knew that they were completely sincere without being pious. They had a tremendous sense of humour in delivering some very grave and consequential things that you need to be able to say about a world you're actually living in altogether, because it was never on a soapbox talking down to people, those songs. They were always about saying, we are, you know, just because you're nobody, you know, because that's what, unfortunately, some forces in that society were telling people then, yeah.
They used to encourage people to get on stage with them at the end. So there would be a group of maybe 10 musicians on stage and then another 100 people who climbed on stage from the audience.
Passion for existence and their sensitivity to the dirtiness and unfairness of life. But at the same time, elevating all of that into this amazing, visceral, spiritual thing.
There was this whole time period that maybe doesn't seem like very much, but you lay down friendships at that time, particularly if you want to be a musician or you want to play music with other people. And Coventry, well, it's 350,000. It is city status, but it feels like a town. And particularly if you're a musician in a place like that, you feel as though you know all the other musicians who are around. And that was certainly what went on at that time.
Terry was in a band called Squad. And what we used to do, right, because we had a regular spot at Mr. George's nightclub in Coventry on a Monday night, and what we would do, we'd get bands to headline, and we'd support them. When we saw Squad and Terry's vision and his voice, Jerry decided, well, this is a guy for the band.
We were one of the first punk bands in Coventry.
That's when you were in Squad, weren't you?
Yeah.
Terry, who was like this sort of bit of calm in this storm that was going on. But he was incredibly charismatic. He just grew in stature as a front man.
The first time we were going to a studio with Pete Waterman, Berwick Street, and Pete goes, fucking hell, where did he get him from? The way Terry just nailed it. One take each song, you know? And that was the voice of the band then.
This was a new form of music, you know, a new fusion of all the things that were around at the time. It wasn't a mystery if you knew anything about music, but it kind of brought together rock, to a certain extent, pop, soul, and punk, and reggae, and rocksteady, and bluebeat, and it just put them all into this melting pot, along with these very opinionated people, because, you know, both the Selector and the Specials were full of a lot of egos, but it just produced an incredible time in music.
So I grew through all those different changes in music, you know? So it was, to me, it was like,
what a wonderful idea to put the energy of punk into reggae.
There'd already been one kind of ska wave in about 64 when Prince Buster came over and a few other artists, and people started to copy as best they could those styles. It was just another dance craze like the twist.
We all do the twist nowadays, unless we're a bit past it.
I think Jerry bought this Prince Buster album to rehearsal one time and said, OK, this is what we're going to do. Silverton, our original drummer, quit.
Because Silverton left the band, and that's how John Bradbury joined the band. If you listen to the way John plays drums, right, you think to yourself, who does most of the improvising in the band? Usually the guitar player or the keyboard player. Not with this band. Brad, you listen to his playing and all his drumming, he's always improvising. That's what made the special sound.
He's one of the few, you know, white guys who could play reggae competently. But he could also play rock and roll as well, and he had a good swing.
I used to join them occasionally after the Body Snatchers split. They were playing at Hope and Anchor, which was for blanket coverage, and I was asked to come down and sing on stage. And it's really funny, like, there's footage of it, and they get the footage out, and, oh, yeah, look at this, unbelievable. And I look at it and I just think, oh, my God.
Introducing ska was the big thing. We played these sort of like a punk song, then we play a reggae song, and so it was like two separate bands on stage. It wasn't sort of working, but ska was like the unifying factor. That was when the Specials started to become the Specials.
Roddy had exactly what was needed for that combination of personalities. He's in the band doing what he does.
Roddy was the punk rocker.
Roddy Byers, wonderful songwriter, wrote Little Rich Girl and that Amy Winehouse covered, lovely song.
Neville didn't arrive till kind of quite late on, and he was this kind of wild man on stage. He was like this incredible force of nature.
Ringmaster and the rabble rouser and all of that.
Neville, visually, he was the dynamite. He was the guy that you put him on the stage and the whole room lit up through Neville, visually, and his energy was just absolutely amazing. Really a wonderful entertainer.
I Neville used to scale the PA stack, and they were pretty wobbly in those days, and all, you know, sort of various old bits and pieces plugged together that may or may not work. But he used to scale these things every single night, shirt off, muscles rippling. He did that in the middle of the set. And he not only did that, he sung Monkey Man. I mean, he would play that to the hilt, straight at them. And I've never seen anything done on stage as brave as that. That was a statement. That was an almighty statement.
Most of the gigs I've been to are for, like, the skinny white dudes with the guitars. And then there was these guys, and I just thought, what are they all about? I mean, it was all a bit weird. Some of them were middle class, some of them were art school, some of them were, you know, sort of proper West Indian geezers. And then there was like this kind of white working class element. My initial impression, I suppose, is like I was trying to work them out. What are you all about?
I think there are two sorts of groups, you know what I mean? There's the groups where everybody's mates at school and they think, we're great mates, we want to stay together. What can we do to stay together? I know we'll all learn musical instruments and we'll become a pop group. So there's that sort of group. Then there's the other group where there's the guy who has the idea. I go, right, I've got these songs and I need a drummer, I need a bass player, I need a, you know, guitar. So you and you. And that was the Specials. We ended up seven very different people that were sort of unified by this music, but it took a long time to get it together. So it wasn't like instant stardom. It was a real struggle. The overnight sensation after 7 years.
I think that what we benefited from in terms of bands that were coming together, you know, both black people and white people, and making a kind of music, was we had the opportunity to listen to each other's music. People, you know, rub shoulders with each other at school. There was this wonderful place called the Holyhead Youth Centre, where a lot of those people that were in the Specials or in the Selector had come together in previous incarnations of bands. And eventually it all coalesced out into those two particular
New York
bands.
2022.
Are you ready for this?
I love the New Orris.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, we love the New Orris. The Old Orris, oh, God. Well, the Old Orris was never there anyway, you know?
I've got very few memories of the Old Orris.
Imagine, yeah, 40
there
years.
There you go.
And we only literally met Orris last year.
Yeah.
We're doing the record.
Yeah.
That's where we actually get to know who Orris was.
Yeah.
He was this invisible guy that comes in and disappears, you know?
Yeah.
I do love the New Orris. He's proper.
It changed, Horace, when you rewrote the third verse.
Oh, God,
I saw the old Horace go.
Yes.
And this new, the Phoenix, just...
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Come out of the thing. It's just like a butterfly, you know?
Like a butterfly.
Yeah. There it is, the new Orris.
He was a moth.
He was a moth.
2019, we released Encore. It was really good, everybody facing the right way and everybody just, you know, turning up on time, really wanting to play their best.
I'm pleased with that record. Very proud of that record.
Universal Music Group took it on board. It was great.
It was all about sort of trust, really. And, you know, for me to sort of trust them, given everything that they'd done, I wasn't worried at all. How good it was going to be, you don't know. There's always that risk.
Neville got ill and he left, and then Roddy quit. So there were four of us left, all facing the right direction. So this will be a good time to do it. Then Brad died, and that was like, ah.
A black and white photo of John Bradbury playing the drums, 1953 to 2015. The screen fades to black. Linval.
With Encore, we were sober. You know, we're more mature and grown up and take life a lot more serious.
So there was just Terry, Linval and I. But we were working with some amazing musicians. We had Kenrick Rowe on drums. Nikolai Torp-Larsen, who'd been Jerry's replacement since 2008, was really coming into his own. He's a fantastically talented keyboard player.
He's such an amazing musician. So he's been our musical director on the Encore album.
Steve Craddock from Ocean Colour Scene and Paul Weller's band was playing guitar.
I mean, working with this man has been a blessing, man. That's what it is. Music, love. Yeah, wicked, man. So what can I say? I'm the best of my life now, no? Wicked.
So it was like this dream team of musicians. OK, let's get some material together. And we did, and it was an absolute joy.
His name is Nikolai.
Thank you, Dan.
Yes, and he's helped put this record together with us, co-wrote and produced this record with us, and, man, fantastic job he's done.
I think they just revisited a lot of the themes which had inspired them originally. They were all too relevant all over again.
Social disorder, like last year's Handsworth riot and the one in Tottenham, North London, has delayed.
Nobody wants to take away from people that right to demonstrate.
Society is their muse to some extent, isn't it? It's looking at what's out there, specifically bands like this, and going, how do we reflect that back?
Terry became such an amazingly confidential songwriter.
You only had to sort of look at the form and look at what Funboy 3 had achieved. Terry obviously went on to the colour field, and again, you know, look at the hits and what they did.
I could be the one thing left in your hour of need. So if you decide to change your view.
Terry Hall in the colour field video for Thinking of You.
The Specials was more a band and an attitude and a thing, but some of his songs after that, I could relate to them as a songwriter, a young songwriter. She may be the
reason I... Terry sings in the video for She.
Wherefore I am could take her laughter and her tears and make them all my souvenirs. For where she goes, I've got to be. The meaning of my life is she.
Vegas, Dave Stewart, Gorillaz.
The Gorillaz animated music video in the studio with Damon Albarn.
I never knew you could get that kind of Arabic sort of. I've never heard you sing those, you know, like that. First time something like that.
I started working in Iranian. So
like, really?
Yeah. There you go.
Perfect.
I can't overstate how much of an influence he was. Someone like Gorillaz is, as he said in our first documentary, he was asked, what are Gorillaz? And he just looked at the camera and went, me. Really argue with.
He'd been so productive and his output was so sort of diverse as well.
It wasn't like it was new for him, you know, that he had a load of lyrics. So it was just basically individuals bringing stuff to the table.
When I played it, I just thought, well, they've just picked everything up from Ghost Town.
I think the time, you know, the one thing with the specials, we always have such amazing timing. And that song, if we vote for you, do you promise to be upright, decent and honest and have our best interests at heart, Boris? It says a lot.
There are no rocks at Rockaway Beach, and all that glitters isn't gold.
The animated music video depicts police holding back protesters. In full riot gear, the police brandish batons. The protesters are cast in silhouette by fires burning behind them. Sparks fleetingly illuminate their faces.
And I think voting was excellent because it proved how terrible these politicians are and their lies and what they do. And we just, all we ask them, if we vote for you, you promise to be upright, decent and honest. Huh? Have they been upright, decent and honest? Definitely not.
A performance at the 100 Club.
For freedom, for nothing, little blues like you to come and do the work we do. You bring shame on this country, we're true, embarrassed by you. We never fought for freedom, for nothing, little blues like you to come and do the work we do. You bring shame on this country, we're true, embarrassed by you.
The idea that a project with Terry, Linval and Horace wouldn't be exciting, wouldn't be special, it's obvious to me. You know, that said, I was extremely nervous when the finished record arrived, you know, and I got a bottle of wine, just sort of preparing myself, you know, and then was just really, really, really pleased.
That's our first number one album as well. And if you listen to music and see from More Specials to Encore, you can see the musical progression. Oh, we grew.
Enjoy yourself while you're still in the pit.
He says that this is what we have to deal with. You see what, where the problems lie, and we have to deal with this.
Come join
it. Right, come join it.
All right. Wicked, yeah.
The LA day was, I mean, the whole thing was bonkers, actually. I had a sort of camera following them around, and you know, it was a beautiful thing as well, but it was also this quite bizarre experience, really.
It's Wednesday, and we're at City Hall, and today has been announced Specials Day in LA.
We were contacted by Councillor Monica Rodriguez.
The Specials Day in LA.
She suggested that there be a Specials Day in Los Angeles, and there was.
When it first came up, I think everybody was just, you know, knocked out by it. And it was really, I guess, to acknowledge the influence and the impact that they'd had on certain bands, a scene, etc., out there in the US. They'd inspired a number of bands that had gone on to be extremely successful.
In 1990, when I was in Special Beat, we were touring America to this new ska audience, and all these kids would come up to me and go, "Hey, we saw the Specials on Saturday Night Live. It was fucking fantastic, man!" You know, but it got repeated and got repeated and got repeated, and just became this sort of cornerstone of what would become this big ska movement. And then you had bands like, you know, Operation Ivy, who became Rancid, and then the Mighty Boss Tones, and eventually sort of people like No Doubt. So all these like million-selling bands that cited the Specials as their influence.
We declare May 29th the Specials Day in LA.
So Terry and I and our manager, Steve, we went to the council office at Council Chambers, and we were feted by the great and the good and given this big certificate. It's funny, because Limbaugh had collapsed. He was recovering in the hotel.
And Horace, you know, kind of was brilliant, actually. Just made a fantastic speech, which sums it all up beautifully.
It was great, you know. Thank you, Los Angeles. You have great taste in music.
It was just bizarre because it felt like we were on a film set, or it was like a TV scene, and Judge Judy or Bruce Willis to come through at some point. Neither did. It's just a fantastic day.
But beautiful as well, and it's quite a giggle, quite a laugh.
We formed our band in Coventry, which is a small city in the Midlands, and 40 years later, to be recognised by a city 6,000 miles away is quite bizarre, but also really rewarding, because it feels like it sort of validates what we've done in the last 40 years, and people on another continent can connect with what we're trying to do, and that is really important. It's important. The message is important, and it translates, which is fantastic.
It's a pity that I did get sick, because I was dehydrated and all that, and I couldn't get to go to the wonderful ceremony. I was meant to be master of ceremony.
No, I know. You
I know.
I would have been, yes. But I could.
I know.
I was sick.
But
sick.
Fate works in strange ways.
Thank you very much, Earth. Thank you. You're a gentleman.
When Monica announced that you couldn't be there,
shut up.
The whole council stood up and cheered.
It wasn't like that. It was not like that.
Everyone.
No, it wasn't like that.
They were happy because they were going to make lunch.
2015, and our support band were Fishbone, who were an amazing band who'd come out of Los Angeles. The only band I was ever worried about sharing a stage with. Norbert Fisher, their bass player, was a monster player. He came down and sat down next to me before they went on, and he goes, "Horace, you don't know what you guys did back in the day." He goes, "We were these black guys, and we were into Devo, and we went to see Dance Craze, and we formed a band."
Archive footage of the Specials. Horace dances as he plays bass. The audience push right up against the lip of the stage, bob their heads and wave their hands in time with the music. Archive footage of a group of punks in 1977. Pauline Black.
Well, the Clash had played around with reggae. They'd mixed that up with rock music, and that was a great music for the time. But what Jerry's genius was, he thought, yeah, but you could dance to this as well, not just get stoned to it. So he married that up with something which was a precursor to that, and really where Bob Marley started. I mean, Bob Marley was a rude boy. So was Peter Tosh. I mean, that whole styling of Walt Jabsco, the whole black and white kind of, you know, little cartoon figure that graces many of the two-tone releases was all taken from that particular image.
A lot of kids wore variations on modern, and later, towards the end of the 60s, skinhead stars. We didn't really have a lot of those in our school, but they were around in that part of the world, and we usually stayed out of the way of them. The Specials immediately had this contradiction to that idea that there was something inherently hostile about these styles, because they were a mixed-race band.
Reggae finds its content in the ability of the artist to feel and to investigate the facts of the society, to appreciate the suffering of the dispossessed and the oppressed. You see, that for me is a stark fact, and the skinhead is able to discover the society in which he lives and to discover himself through the medium of reggae and eventually his relationship to the world at large.
The iconography and the imagery and the look and feel of this band and the energy that they brought to the songs that they sung, to me, just resonated.
I think we were in the right place at the right time. Punk was kind of like dying on its arse. The Sex Pistols had split up, the Clash were discovering America, and something new needed to come along.
All of those things were around and they were available, mainly because those kinds of music had happened 20 years before, and here it was being recycled. I mean, we tend to get this recycling in sort of 20-year periods, which is when one generation has outgrown the clothes, and so they give all their clothes away to the Oxfam shop, and some bright spark in a band somewhere goes, "Ah, those Stay Press look good, let's try those out." And then others go, yeah, I think they're good, I think I'll get a pair and some Docs.
I was a big sort of fan of the Jam. So it was a sort of short walk, really, from the suits that they were wearing to the suits that the Specials and other two-tone bands were wearing. And so image-wise, it kind of felt like it was in the same sort of area.
We were just copying the mods from, like, 1964, really, and the skinhead fashions as well from, like, sort of a little bit later. So we were just sort of combining that. So you had a sharper look. The op art design, you know, the Bridget Riley, you know, the black and white squares, I mean, that was from the 60s as well. So it was all borrowed from mod iconography, really.
Smart, Stay Press, you know, two-tone, Brutus, Ben Sherman, the Loafers, that was it.
They had actually dialed in a sort of subculture, you might say, of people, like, wearing these clothes, which I hadn't seen since 69.
You could buy second-hand tonic suits, you know, up Gosford Street. The suit I wear on that first album cost me £6.50. It cost me more to get it, you know, altered so that it fitted me properly.
Chalky Davis and took the cover shot of the Specials. That's a pretty great photograph. It really caught them the way they were at that moment. You know, all their personalities are really apparent. Black and white photography, it was in keeping with the colour scheme of the label, two-tone.
You had ourselves, the Selector, and the Specials in Coventry. You had the Beat in Birmingham. You had Madness in London. And then later, I mean, when we all got going, the Body Snatchers. It was all there. The precursor, of course, was the Specials. It gave rise to this movement that a lot of people had joined to. We did an album, and I think we did four singles before, you know, to a certain extent, we saw the writing on the wall and how unruly the whole thing was getting, and decided we'd go our own way.
1981. Archive news footage. Thatcher.
I know full well the responsibilities that await me as I enter the door of number 10, and I'll strive unceasingly to try to fulfil the trust and confidence that the British people have placed in me and the things in which I believe.
Probably the most extraordinary record they made, I had nothing to do with, which was Ghost Town. I mean, that's like a masterpiece.
It was Margaret Thatcher's period, you know? I think we captured all that there.
It was like perfection.
The music video for Ghost Town. Pauline Black.
The most tremendous backbeat that just made you sit up and listen, with this almost symphonic music going on over the top.
I'm really proud of it because it was recorded in a tiny little basement studio in Royal Leamington Spa on 8 tracks and mixed on a 2-track Revox in our producer John Collins' front room in Tottenham, and it sounds brilliant. All the clubs have been closed down.
This place is got me like a ghost. You know, the clubs are closed down, can't dance here anymore, and that's what happened.
It obviously resonated with an awful lot of people in England, because they all went out and bought it.
What was being spoken and the experience of the people who were listening to them, there was a resonance between the two, and at the time, they communicated absolutely.
If you listen to the lyrics, it catches the mood of the moment, it catches the culture and challenges that are going on in this country.
I don't think there's been anything that's been as socially relevant since.
I mean, it seems even more relevant today. And the lyrics, you know, they just really resonated at the time.
Terry's unbelievable delivery of those lyrics.
So we done this gig in Rotherham. We then got on a bus and then drove all the way down to London, where we got there about sort of midnight. And then it's, right, guys, we're going to do a video. Here's the car, sit in the back of it, and let's go. So we were knackered, you know, and we was like, we're driving backwards and forwards the Blackwall Tunnel. I got to drive it. It was great. It was really good. 1962 Vauxhall Cresta, 3-speed stick shift. Yeah, crazy. Crazy.
So this is the original, apparently, is the original, or the front half of the original 1962 Vauxhall Cresta that we used in the Ghost Town video.
Timing for Ghost Town was incredible. That record can be put in the archives and just sit there. Ghost Town captured a vibe, you know, what was happening, the riots and all that, you know?
It so succinctly epitomised a time, how people were thinking, the problems that there were in Coventry and up and down the country in that kind of Thatcher period of the early 80s. It just kind of, the melancholy and the alienation that a lot of young people were thinking at that time, it fully encapsulated all of that.
They should be proud of that record.
If you want to know about the history of where we're coming from, listen to Ghost Town, tell you everything.
It was definitely a high point to go out on.
To me, it just feels like we capture the time.
A whole generation of people sort of grew up at least having some sort of answers to the world that they were being faced with.
Would you say you've got an identity problem?
Yeah. Because no man that was born in England, no black man that was born in England, is meant to be called British.
Why not?
Well, we've been brought over here and we're bottom of the table. We've been treated bad. And if a man asks me, was I born in England? If I am British, I'm not going to say yes. I'm not going to say, yeah, I come from that place that I've been being treated bad in.
2020 was very much the year of protest, Black Lives Matter protests in America, and just sort of general sort of civil unrest that I think was more the responsibility of lockdowns, where everybody, you know, just sort of went home and went mad. For now you
see the light. Archive footage of riots in the UK, police manhandle a black woman, people attack members of the National Front marching through the street.
It was a different time. People say too much that, oh, you know, 1979, well, yes, I mean, that was terrible then, and it's terrible now as well. Yes, it is. And all of those things are out there, but we talk about them now. You know, Black Lives Matter movement has happened. The Me Too movement has happened. These are different times.
Protest songs. We started work on the next album, obviously, through the pandemic, 2 years out. We decided, well, let's fill the gap in.
I think that's an interesting record. It wasn't actually what they planned to do. after Encore. But COVID came along and all the sort of initial talk and plans that were kind of being had were kind of forced to go on the back burner because they couldn't obviously get together and work in the way that they would normally choose to work.
So it was like, well, this isn't new. You know, here are some songs where people had, you know, used music as a form of protest. But that's kind of what the Specials were about anyway. Stupid Marriage is a protest song. Too Much, Too Young is a protest song. So it wasn't like anything new. But, like, OK, here we go. Here's something that was written in 1965 that's a protest song. Here's something that was written in, you know, 1973 or something.
A montage. People protest the poll tax. A headline. Thatcher quits. An anti-Trump protest.
They are, or were, the archetypal covers band. If you think back, you know, they did so many covers right from day one. So the idea that they did this sort of protest songs collection of covers, you know, I think is particularly pertinent.
Obviously, what was happening in the world? We decided to just wake up people that this has been going on for years.
It was a kind of interim record, but they were all had this sort of theme of protest songs. And also it was another factor in that redefining ourselves. And it worked. And it still sounded like the Specials.
It pushed it as well, I think, for people, which is a good thing.
It was a great record to do, because Terry knew what the words were going to be, because it was, you know, the other people had sung them.
Every single you go to, you switch TV on, there's Bonanza. So funny. Yes, I do. I
live in a... Terry drives Horace and Linvale around New York.
This is like Lester to me, no worries.
Lester.
2022.
We wanted to make a reggae album, and I'd had some reggae tunes, so there was music, and I know Terry had been writing, he had notebooks. Him, Linvale and I were getting really quite tight. We had this sort of survivor mentality, and it was just a question of then we were going to do sort of pre-production work where the music was going to be introduced to the words, or the words were going to be introduced to the music. But then Terry phoned up and said that he was sick.
When he rang me up, I was so happy. I go, bloody hell, man. I used to have to ring him, send him texts, because that's how he worked. Send him texts back, blah, blah. And when he said to me, you know, you're the only one that I've rung on the phone.
Linvale reflects.
I will remember that for the rest of my life.
I think Linvale tried to call me during the day to say he's dying, but didn't get through, and then finally got through to say I was walking home from work, and he just said, you know, Terry's gone. And I was like, what? What? You know, because I didn't know there was anything wrong.
But I didn't tell anyone anything. None of us knew. No one.
Brave doesn't quite go there, but it was quite incredible, I thought. It takes a certain kind of person and a real sort of strength inside, I think, to particularly the position that he was in.
Steve Blackwell, our manager, called me on a Sunday, and he never phones on a Sunday. And he says, look, Terry's condition is a lot worse. And he died 18th of December. You know, was that 6 weeks later, something like that?
Damon Albarn sits listening to music, deep in thought. He reflects, his eyes full of sadness. Emotional Damon looks away, a home video of Damon playing. Richard Wiley, event organiser.
So today would have been Terry Hall's 64th birthday, so I, along with the Two Tone Village and a club from Coventry, just wanted to put a ride on as a mark of respect to recognise and celebrate the legacy of music that the Specials, Terry Hall, brought to us and to honour his legacy. Like, we've had over 500 scooters turn up today. Every one of them here have that same feeling and passion and love for the Specials and what they stood for, and the music.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you know, he was fantastic. I mean, he was very considered, and he could be extremely funny, very humorous.
He acknowledged and shared with people the consequences of suffering from depression and could both write about it, and at times, obviously, it's clearly burdened him. But the fact that he was able to do that for people who were in that position who didn't have the same voice he had is amazing.
When it comes to this part now, where I've done with Terry, I just feel I just have to go and talk about who Terry was.
He had very, very attuned sense of humour.
There was always something to laugh about. He was ever so funny. No matter what the situation was, you know, there would be a wry smile or some sort of, you know, comment.
What was he like to work with?
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, he's brilliant, man. Yeah, I mean, I love you, Terry.
My relationship with Terry was just two guys, one of them who admired the other.
He knew how to wear clothes. Certainly when he was younger. Somehow he was breathing other air to the other members of the band, and when you look back now and you look at Dance Craze, everything was concentrated in him. All the men wanted to be him, and all the women wanted to love him.
Thanks very much. This next song is dedicated, sorrowfully, to the 2 million unemployed. It's also dedicated to everybody who hasn't finished their scampi. It's called Do Nothing.
Archive footage from a specials gig.
Each day I walk along this lonely street, trying to find a future. New pair of shoes are on my feet, 'cause fashion is my only culture. Nothing ever changed.
Person, and very few people actually have that they're their own person, particularly people in the entertainment industry. There's a lot of people trying to be whoever they think they ought to be at the time, and I don't really have much time for people like that because they have no centre. But he looked as though he had a centre.
Manchester Apollo, and like in between songs, you know, and he grabs the mic and he walks along the lip of the stage and he says, OK, let's play Guess the Fashion Retailer, you know, and he'd look to the audience and he goes, ah, Georgia Asda, you know, Primark, Matalan, must do better. It was really funny. He never did it again. That was the only time he ever did it. But there was this real sort of sense of humour, sense of fun about him. I will miss that.
You know, a very talented and kind and interesting and intriguing man. There was this innate serenity about him, challenged serenity for lots of reasons, but just a very gifted, kind and warm soul.
Definitely the nicest and the friendliest and the most down-to-earth.
And he did definitely have star quality. I mean, it was... And I don't think it was any accident that any version of the Specials without him just really didn't make it.
To go on the stage and perform those songs without him, I can't see that.
Listening to your two albums, there's a marked difference from the first and to the second. What happened?
Well, I mean, the band's got to develop, you know? I mean, you could tell probably the next album could be fake jazz. I don't know yet.
Fake music.
Yeah,
but still it's a big step from playing ska and sort of...
Never played ska.
You didn't?
No, everybody thinks we did, but we didn't.
What have you been playing all these years that we didn't know about?
Punk rock.
Punk rock?
Yeah, it's just an extension of that.
I think we were the voice of the people, and when you're there and you become the voice of the people, it's a very important job, it's a responsible job. You got to take that seriously, you know? And that's what we did. If we're going to be the voice of the people, we've got to stand up there
because we're speaking on their behalf.
People with different skin colour, coming from different places, all coming together, making music on stage.
It makes me smile. It makes me, I suppose, cry and smile at the same time, his voice.
Those ska rhythms are irresistible. You know, I defy anyone to stay sitting down.
Damon Albarn, you know, when he was a young lad, he saw us, and that's one of the reasons why he wanted to be in a band. You know, that's where you end up forming Blur, you know?
I think everyone influences everybody else. I don't think there's a point where you start a timeline.
I realise how much the Specials means to an awful lot of people.
It was a band that all pulled in opposite directions at once and really only pulled their resources on stage.
I think the lasting legacy of Two Tone Music is the fact that people 44 years later are still listening to it, still going along to gigs, and it's still being talked about, and you're able to make a documentary about the Specials.
The Specials perform at Glastonbury Festival. The huge crowds of festival goers wave their hands in the air and dance to the music.
Stop you fooling around. Straight right out. Better think of your future.
Favourite special. The special special.
My name is.
My name is. Okay. My name is Rhoda Deckard.
You'll be able to edit around some of that fucking waffle, won't you?
You think I know all those things? I got on the bus. I just felt pleased I didn't have to sit at the back.
OK, thank you, folks. You've been a great audience.
Yeah. Were you the youngest?
Yeah, and I still am. It's great.
Terry giggles. The Specials performing at Glastonbury. Bright lights illuminate the huge Glastonbury crowd. Linval.
The legacy of the Specials is special. Very, very special. And I don't think you can change that.
The Specials. Black is the end credits roll. We lost a number of people along the way, like Brad, who never unfortunately saw the success of Encore and protest songs. Terry came back from LA, full of the promise of some of the best songs he'd ever written. We will never hear those songs, and probably never see the likes of the Specials again. Steve Blackwell, manager, the Specials. A photo of Terry Hall, 1959 to 2022.